The World Bank reduces its economic growth outlook for the Philippines amid a resurgence in COVID-19 infections. Unemployment in the country hits 8.7% in April. Malacañang warning health protocol violators of possible murder charges. And Sara Duterte Carpio plays down reports of a possible presidential bid, citing her father's statement she is not fit to succeed him. We'll get the analysis on the latest developments on the political front from De La Salle University Professor Julio Tihanke. Hi, I'm Carmina Constantino. Dateline Philippines begins right now. Thanks for joining us. And for those of you watching us on YouTube and on Facebook, nice to have you with us today. The World Bank downgrading its economic growth outlook on the Philippines. That's amid the resurgence of COVID-19 infections and the reimposition of mobility restrictions, which held back early signs of an economic rebound. Bruce Rodriguez now joins us with details. Bruce, go ahead. What else can you tell us?
Hi, Carmina. That is right. World Bank senior economist Kevin Chua said that the World Bank just downgraded their outlook for the Philippine economy to 4.7% from 5.7% earlier this year. Now, this is, as you mentioned, due to the impact of the resurgence in COVID-19 cases, as well as the reimposition of mobility restrictions to stave off that surge in cases. And also important to note, this is way below government's target growth range of 6 to 7% for 2021. So this makes this somehow is a big hurdle to the economic recovery prospects of the Philippine economy. And also, they're saying that the Philippine economy is still recovering from the recession that we've seen in 2021. But they mentioned, World Bank mentioning, that this heavily hinges on the country's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Especially key to this is its vaccination drive to vaccinate, inoculate a lot or majority of the population as soon as possible. Moving forward, they're also seeing that the 2022 presidential elections is seen to provide a boost to the economy as seen in previous elections, because, of course, this would help boost up consumer demand consumption, which is a big growth driver for the Philippine economy. And if the Philippines does go back to its faster growth trajectory, Chua saying that the Philippine economy reduction, their progress in poverty reduction is seen to go back to their earlier levels once this continues. And, of course, once more jobs are generated in the economy. Overall, the World Bank has has four policy recommendations for the Philippines in order for it to really boost its economic recovery prospects. And number one, as mentioned earlier, is the key health policy response against the health crisis. And this is the management of the COVID-19 virus. And the rollout of the vaccination program. Next is effectively delivering social protection programs to help those sectors that was hard hit by this pandemic. And of course, to make the human capital accumulation more resilient. Third is mobilizing greater private sector participation in public infrastructure projects. So this is the build a program of the administration, ramping that up. And lastly is relaxing the restriction on foreign direct investment. This is really an expected big boost to economic recovery. Carmina.
All right. Bruce, did the analysis also make any mention of how it is going to be an election year next year and how that is going to impact on the numbers, Bruce?
Right. Right, Carmina. Of course, this is really a big event that economists, the World Bank, are really watching out for. The World Bank earlier mentioning that the 2022 presidential elections can provide somehow a boost to consumption, which is a big growth driver for the Philippine economy. And of course, once we see a lot of these potential candidates doing their campaigns, really spurring demand, spurring consumption, spurring spending, we would see somehow a slight growth bump or growth boost to the Philippine economy. And but of course, aside from the 2022 elections, World Bank reiterated that the key factor, the key driver that could boost the Philippine economic prospects is, of course, the response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
All right. Thanks a lot. Bruce Rodriguez there joining us on the line. Take care, Bruce. Keep safe.
Thank you.
Right, moving on, the unemployment rate in the Philippines hits 8.7% in April. That translates to 4.14 million jobless Filipinos. It's an increase from the 3.44 million unemployed in March. The National Capital Region had the highest jobless rate at 14.4%. The increase can be attributed to the reimposition of a lockdown in the NCR and surrounding provinces back in April. As for sectors, construction saw the biggest decline in jobs. It's followed by agriculture and forestry and wholesale and retail trade. The education and services sectors, meanwhile, had the biggest increase in April. The Philippine government's economic managers say the slight uptick in unemployment last month shows the close link between labor and COVID-19 quarantine restrictions. We're back here, still on Dateline Philippines here on ANC. We apologize for that technical glitch. You know how it is these days. Anyway, we were still talking about that 8.7% jobless rate. The Philippine government economic managers say the slight uptick in unemployment last month shows the close link between COVID-19 quarantine restrictions and labor. In a joint statement, they said unemployment was more pronounced in regions where stricter quarantine protocols were implemented. However, the economic team also said April's unemployment rate is better than the 17.6% recorded last year. With a decline in COVID-19 cases within the NCR Plus bubble, the managers recommend further reopening the economy along with stimulus packages. The COVID-19 transmission rate in northern Mindanao now at 91%. That's according to the director of the Northern Mindanao Health Department. Out of the 25,511 total infections recorded there, the region currently has close to 3,000 active cases. A third of these cases are from Cagayan de Oro. 75% of the ICU beds in Cagayan de Oro are currently occupied. This puts the city under a high-risk classification.
1 month before, hindi ganito ang picture natin. Marami tayong recovered. Uh-huh. Ang 10% lang yata ang active cases. But the recent uptake of cases, this is the real situation now.
Malacanang raising the possibility of slapping murder charges against those intentionally violating health protocols. Chief Presidential Legal Counsel Sal Panelo came up with that idea, which the president backed.
Pero kung alam niya po, pumunta siya sa isang lugar, alam niyang may sakit siya ng coronavirus at nakahawa siya at namatay, ay yan po ay talagang sadyang pagpatay yan. Papasok po yan sa murder. Sapagkat intentional, alam mo na nga makakahawa.
Kung sabi mo murder, although medyo malayo masyado sa isip ng tao yan, but it is possible. If he knows that he is sick with COVID-19 and he goes about nonchalant, o pasyal-pasyal ka lang dyan, maybe if it is intentional, malayo yan, pero it could be murder, sabi nga ni Sal. At kung hindi, yung reckless imprudence would really mas swak doon sa sitwasyon na yun.
But the Integrated Bar of the Philippines points out, while charging quarantine violators with murder is possible, there has to be proof of intent to kill.
Hindi lang yung may intention maglalat ng bayan. May intention na pumatay. Yung murder yan, dapat yung intention na yan, may pinagplanuhan o yun. Kaya patraidor.
Oo, establish mo pa yun.
Mas mataas pa yung kwan kasi nga may mga qualifying circumstance pag murder ang ikakaso mo eh.
Close to 500 Filipino factory workers in Taiwan currently in quarantine. That's after a local transmission of COVID-19 hit a dorm housing Filipinos. An official from the Manila Economic and Cultural Office, or MECO, says 200 people from that dorm have tested positive for the virus so far. He adds the infection has spread to at least 3 other companies employing dozens of Filipinos. MECO now asking Taiwan to include Filipino workers in the priority list for COVID-19 vaccination.
Unfortunately, meron din po silang nakahalubilo na although hindi pa natetest, they're awaiting their results. So a total of below 500 of our kababayan out of the 1,700 na Pinoy nagtatrabaho doon have now been quarantined. Nag-file po ako ng diplomatic note verbale sa Taiwan na government urging or appealing na isama sa priority ang mga naka-dorm na kababayan natin, pati ang caregivers.
Some residents who belong to the A4 category in Caloocan City lined up as early as 5 in the morning to get vaccinated. Most of them are construction workers or house helpers who took a leave from work to get their shots. Qualified residents need to sign up at the village office or register online. Over in Manila, a vaccination center had to close as early as 7 in the morning because its supply ran out. The city government allocated 750 doses for each of the 4 vaccination centers for the A4 category. President Rodrigo Duterte orders local government units to find those who missed their second COVID-19 vaccine shot. That's after the health department said 9% or around 113,000 vaccine recipients who got their first dose failed to show up for their second inoculation.
Mahirapan talaga akong magkumbinsi sa Pilipino, lalo na yung matigas ng ulo. I want the authorities and the LGUs to find out why this is happening and to take steps to return to their ma-imber na sila na madala ng mga barangay captain pati mayors. Kindly help us ferret out the persons who have not received the second booster until now.
The Philippine Food and Drug Administration grants emergency use approval to the COVID-19 vaccines donated by Chinese firm Sinopharm. President Duterte raised eyebrows last month after he was inoculated with Sinopharm shot. Back then, it was only covered by a compassionate use permit. The jab was part of 10,000 Sinopharm doses donated by China. Davao City Mayor Sara Duterte Carpio accuses Malacañang and opposition coalition group Isambayan of playing what she called a slapping contest over a proposed Duterte-Duterte tandem in the 2022 elections. Duterte Carpio says she doesn't understand all the fuss since her father had already declared she is unfit to be a president because she is a woman. Her statement comes as the ruling PDP Laban Party called on President Duterte to run as vice president while welcoming his daughter as their possible presidential bet. Opposition groups see a Duterte-Duterte tandem as unconstitutional and a move toward political dynasty. For an analysis of the recent developments in the political arena, we are now joined by De La Salle Political Science and International Studies Professor Julio Tihanki. Professor July, nice to see you again, and thank you for joining us. Appreciate you joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Casey. And
there you go.
It's good to be back. It's good to be back. Thank you for inviting me.
Nice to have you back. All right. Let's first begin with this question. How would you define opposition these days? Are all those running or planning to run against the administration automatically considered as opposition, Professor?
Okay, of course, if you define the opposition, opposition would naturally be those who were defeated in the previous presidential election and those who have been opposed to the policies of this government ever since. No? So we refer here to the former members of the Liberal Party, which used to be the administration party and their allies. No? So they are the opposition.
They are the true opposition here. So, and of course, we have to say that we have a multi-party system, right?
Yes.
So for Isang Bayan and even Vice President Lenny Robredo, for them to say that there should be only one presidential candidate or one bet for the opposition, what do you make of that?
Of course, if we say that the Liberal Party is the natural opposition, but of course we have to remember that the Liberal Party has its allied parties and movements and groups. No? So you have this coalition of opposition parties and movements, which now compose Isang Bayan. No? And of course, it is it doesn't take a political scientist to say that the opposition should be united in the next round of presidential election. No? So this very idea of a united front is actually a good idea because there is really a need to consolidate all the forces who are opposed to this administration because this administration, despite all the controversies, despite all the issues that have been raised, despite all the sins of omission or commission thrown at this administration, there is no doubt that this administration is still popular and still enjoys, and the president enjoys a huge following from its base constituency. So it is incumbent upon the opposition to consolidate its forces. Now, unfortunately, as we have seen in 2016, after the defeat of the Liberal Party and its alliance, no, it has been weakened, no, by party defection, by party switching, and it lost the midterm elections. No, so if that's any indication, apparently the political opposition has not learned from the lessons of its defeat in 2016 and in 2019. So at the rate things are going and at the rate Isang Bayan is trying to unite the opposition, it's apparent that they're still using the very same strategy. They're telling the same narrative that they have shared with the electorate in the past two electoral cycles.
So having said that, I mean, what should the narrative be coming from Isang Bayan and their allied forces? If
well,
you're saying they're using the same formula, what formula should they use?
Okay. Apparently, the opposition is still sticking with the narrative of moral politics, no? And their core message is, vote for us. We're good people. No, that has been the narrative of the liberals, no, the narrative of its the so-called yellow political force, no, it's the EDSA narrative, no, vote for us because we're good people. No? The problem is what concerns majority of our voters is not simply a question of good or bad people; it's a question of good or bad systems, no, and in addition, moral politics tend to be self-righteous. No, it tends to often blame. They often blame the poor. No, the bobotantes. No, and ironically, this kind of narrative strengthens the very narrative of this populist president, of this populist administration, because for populism, the narrative is, trust me because I am one of you. No, mm-hmm. Vote for me because I am one of you. And look at this these elites, no, the hypocrisy of these elites, they're looking down at us. So ironically, while it is the task of the political opposition to call out this administration, no, they should also be sensitive to the trap that they might be seen as playing the moral political card.
Well, so far we've talked about the opposition, we've talked about the electorate, but what about the political elite? That these parties sort of play to as well in order to get the funding, in order to get the support that they need.
Yes. So the dilemma right now is really after 6 years of almost 6 years, no, or 5 years of this administration, this administration is truly a different kind of administration. It has disrupted the usual way of doing politics in this country. And after what we've been through, no, and we still are facing big problems, no, such as the pandemic, no, and the need to rebuild the country for a post-pandemic world. And then we have the geopolitical issues, the competition of the big powers, right, in our area of responsibility. No, we need more stability. No, we need the next president should have the vision, the experience, the competency, the courage, and the stability. No, so the key here is, while Duterte, the president, is still popular, he has the incumbency advantage, no? And his anointment will carry a big weight, no? It will be a factor in 2022.
Still? You still think that despite the reality that we face right now? The joblessness,
yes.
The pandemic?
Yes, because unlike previous administration, like for example, the previous administration, the Aquino administration, the popularity tapered off at the tail end of his administration, and he was not able to transfer it to his successor. Here, what we're seeing is we are already reaching the end of this administration, and still the president, despite everything that's been thrown at him, despite everything that he has done, remains popular. No? So popularity plus the incumbency advantage will be a big factor for whoever will be the anointed one. No?
By the way, Professor Tihanki, before we continue, I mean, here we are talking about 2022 when it's, you know, months away. And we've heard some of these would-be candidates say that, you know, it's still too early to talk about politics. There are a lot of pressing issues hounding the country right now. Why even talk about 2022? But what do you think? Is it really too early to talk about this?
Well, some would say it's too early, no? But if we are under extraordinary circumstances because of the pandemic, no? Under the usual electoral cycle, most of these candidates would have bombarded us with their propaganda, and they've already introduced themselves as early as last year, no? But because of the pandemic, no, it would be insensitive and politically incorrect to reveal their political ambitions at this time. So the mantra of most presidential wannabe is it's too early, no, and we should focus on the pandemic, which is what they should really do instead of promoting themselves, no. So it is a smart political strategy for them to keep quiet. But of course, we all know that they already have made a decision, most of them. No? They're saying that they have not, but I'm sure by this time they have already weighed the pros and cons of running for the presidency.
Okay, let's go through the names that have been floated lately. Let's first talk about the Sara Duterte and Guibo Teodoro tandem. What do you make of that? Make it very, very brief, because we do have a host of names that we have to go through. Go ahead.
So it's It's an interesting combination because it's an out of the box combination. A lot of political watchers were waiting for the moves of former Defense Secretary Gilbert Teodoro, no, and they were hoping that he would run for the presidency. But it's a smart move for somebody who's been out of the limelight for quite a long time to go for the second highest position and with one of the early frontliners in the race. So it's a out of the box combination.
Okay. Interesting that you call it out of the box, considering that one of them is, you know, the daughter of a sitting president.
Okay. So let me say something about Mayor Duterte. No? Of course, the big issue for a Mayor Duterte candidacy would, of course, be dynasticism. No? Of course, exactly. Others would say that there have been presidents in the past, no, with Corazon Aquino and Benigno Aquino, with Diosdado Macapagal and Goran Macapagal Arroyo. But the difference is, it's not a back-to-back presidency, no. So the main issue here would be the incumbency advantage, no, because the sitting president has the control of not only the resources but all the political alliances and even the news cycle, no, the media cycle. So the question here really is, if Sara Duterte runs, it's going to be a question of dynasticism.
Yeah. But then, is this something that should even be considered? Is this something that the public outrightly should reject?
Unfortunately, just looking at the fact that 70% of all elected offices in this country, from both national and local, sadly, no, except for some of us who've been advocating for reforms in the political system and a ban on political dynasty, unfortunately, it might not be an issue in this election.
Oh, there are other names. Manny Pacquiao, Isko Moreno. How viable is a run for the presidency or vice presidency for these two?
One way of looking at the forthcoming presidential election is to try to see who might gravitate around the administration and the opposition forces. And of course, clearly, we already have an idea of who are the frontliners in the administration. It's Mayor Sara and perhaps Bongo, no? And even Manny Pacquiao. No? And on the opposition side, of course, we have names, but of course, the front runner would be Vice President Lenny Robredo. Now, I wouldn't like to look at it as a simple contest between the admin and opposition, no? Because there might be a third force, no? And we are already seeing, no, the possibility of a third force that's not identified strictly with the administration or the opposition. And this might be a strategic opportunity for those who are not identified with both the administration and the opposition, because surveys have shown that the percentage of those who are anti-opposition are not as high as those who support the administration, but the number of those who are neutral, who are neither pro-administration or pro-opposition, is actually practically half of the electorate, around 41%. So this is a target, no? For the opposition, the task really is for the opposition to take winnability seriously, no? Because they're against a formidable administration. And the opposition should broaden their base beyond their echo boxes, no? They should target these undecided voters, no? But of course, the question here is whether the undecided voters would be attracted to the opposition or the administration. So there is a big possibility that a third force, a third way candidate might emerge next year.
When you say third way, third force candidate, are you talking about a possible Lacson-Soto tandem?
Oh, there are several potential third way candidates. No, Isko Moreno is one. He's neither fully identified with the admin or the opposition. Grace Po is one. You have Ping Lacson. No, you have other names. No, Manny Pacquiao, the way he's been treated in his current position as acting president in PDP Laban, I wouldn't be surprised if there will be a split within the PDP Laban. And of course, you have other former political personalities identified with the administration who are no longer, who are distancing themselves from the administration. You have a former speaker, Pantaleon Bebot Alvarez, who's rebuilding his own political party. No, of course, we all know that former Speaker Alvarez is not in good terms with Mayor Sara. So
Here's the thing, though, Professor Tihanke. I'm sorry if I put this in edgewise.
Right.
When you talk about neutrality, when you talk about being silent, when you talk about not being allied with the opposition or the administration, I mean, with everything that this country has gone through in the past how many years,
yes,
shouldn't a candidate be out there saying something that may not be popular, but is pro-country, but is yes. pro-people? Now yes. is not the time to yes. be silent or neutral.
Of course, but it depends really, because the issue of the middle class, the issue of the intellectuals, the issue of media practitioners, of business, these are not the issues of the common tao, no? We have to understand, no? And perhaps, no, these are not the issues of the middle class even, no? Perhaps the reason why they're neutral, these undecided voters, is because they've simply tuned out. They've gotten frustrated. They've gotten cynical. They've become jaded because of the failed promises of previous administrations.
No, sorry. I wasn't talking about the voters. I wasn't talking about the electorate. I was talking about would-be candidates who have played silent, who have played neutral,
yeah.
who have been neither here nor there, just because yeah. they're setting their sights on a higher position.
Well,
what does that tell us about them?
Well, it's not up to us, no, to judge them. Let them stand on their record, no, because they have probably different reasons for doing so. No, that there are those, but the simple fact is that those who criticized the administration early on, yeah, we have to acknowledge the fact that they've spoken truth to power, but we should not close our doors to those who later on, no, realize that it's time to speak their mind. No, so
okay.
That's the point. No, we cannot at this point. We need to consolidate. The opposition should consolidate all potential allies, no, to their cause. Now, if you're speaking about the candidates, no, some of them, it's just an accident of history that they have not been traditionally allied with either the administration or the opposition. No, so
okay,
there are really some people who are independent. No, like for example, Senator Grace Po from the very beginning was neither identified with the opposition or
Professor. The sorry to cut you there, but we're running out of time.
We
do need to go to two more questions at least.
Yes.
Meanwhile, all this talk, and we haven't heard anything from Vice President Eleni Robredo. It is a very, very personal decision to make. We understand that.
Yes.
But is there a possibility, though, that the process that she's in right now, really deciding, pinagninilayan niya, really reflecting on the decision that she's about to make, is there a possibility that this process will erode the confidence that the people have in her, her supporters, who are just waiting for her to decide? What do you think about that?
Well, The vice president has done a good job being the leader of the opposition. I think she did very well in the pandemic, no? Offering as much given the limited resources that she had, no? But of course, running for the presidency is a challenging task, especially if you're in the opposition right now, and especially with the state of the opposition. So, of course, we cannot blame the vice president to really take her time to assess her situation, no? And look at the political calculus, no? And given the current situation and the big challenges, no, facing the opposition, she's also looking at her options, and that's really to go back to her base constituency in Camarines Sur.
Okay, finally, Professor Tihanki, a while ago you mentioned about the opposition still going with the narrative that it's a moral fight, that this is about making the right choices, that it shouldn't be about that. But really, Professor, if it's not about that, then what is it about? If it's not about right or wrong, then what are we talking about here? Isn't it
it's offering
to be
a better system?
That?
No, it's offering a better system because this administration is simply an outcome of the weak system, the political system that we've had, no? and the failure of previous administration to really take at a serious structural reform of not only our economy but also our socio-political system. So aside from that, no, they should offer the plan. No, what is, aside from hitting the administration for its shortcomings, no, they should offer the plan, the vision, no, and they should offer someone who is competent and who's competent, who has the experience to push through with these plans.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it at that. Professor Julio Tihanki there.
Thank you, Casey.
The De La Salle University Political Science and International Studies. Appreciate you joining us here on the show. Take care.
Thank you, Casey.
Safe.
Thank you.
Thanks. All right, from there, Filipino-Japanese golfer Yuka Saso gets a huge bump in the world rankings after winning the U.S. Women's Open. She is now ranked 9th. That's up by 31 points from the previous rankings. Here's our North America Bureau Chief DJ Manotok with this exclusive interview of the teen golf sensation.
Good day to everybody watching, and we are here right now. We're fortunate we have some time to speak to the new, I'm getting used to it, Yuka, the 2021 U.S. Women's Open champion, Yuka Saso. How are you feeling? Has it sunk in yet? I mean, you've been walking around the trophy. I see you wearing the medals. Pero, nagsink in na ba? Kumusta nang pakiramdam this morning?
Di po ako masyado nakatulog. Madami, medyo busy lang po. Pero, di ko po lang nag-sink in na. Parang hindi pa po.
Okay. Well, let's talk a bit about your journey since we have some time to chat with you. And I know you've been playing in the Japanese pro tour, but you're only 19 years old, Yuka. Did you think you would get here this soon? You have other, you know, talented Filipino golfers who opted to go to college first, right? Pero ikaw, diretso ka nag pro. Did you think you would get to this level this soon?
Like I always said, I was just grateful that I was able to join my third U.S. Women's Open, and I was also thankful to be able to play with 2015 champion In Ji Chun. That was a very great experience. So I wasn't really expecting anything. I had no pressure, or I had nothing to lose. So, I mean, I just wanted to play golf and, you know, play the best golf I can. And, yeah, I think I did that well.
I want to pick up on that when you said you had nothing to lose, you felt no pressure. That's what some people were saying when you were entering the last 9. You were still down by 4 strokes. It was everything for the leaders to lose for Lexi. Was that really how you felt, that you felt that I'm just going to play my game? No pressure, even though you saw the crowd around you and it was the U.S. Open. So you were just at ease at that moment?
I think, okay, not only me, we all want to win U.S. Women's Open, right? We all want to win a major. So nasa isip ko po na gusto ko manalo ng major. Pero, you know, I still have a long way to go in my career. So, I had no pressure at all. You know, whatever the outcome is, I talk to myself that I'll accept it. And, you know, learn from it and move on. So, yeah, no pressure.
You went through that process quite quickly just yesterday. From the front nine to the back nine, you had those two double bogeys, and you needed some kind of a transformation to bounce back. Talk a bit about how you bounce. Not everybody gets to bounce back from a hole like that, down five strokes because of two back-to-back double bogeys. What was that like in terms of accepting that you did bad at the start and trusting your game, as you said yesterday?
Like I said, my caddy talked to me and said that I have to get back on track. I need to trust myself. You know, there's many holes to go. There's many more chance. So, I mean, that actually made me teary-eyed a little. I had to, you know, like get back on track. I had to, you know, get myself back. And I'm really thankful for him being on my side. I wouldn't be here without him.
Talk a bit about your caddy a little bit more. Not a lot of people are aware how crucial a caddy is in the professional game. I mean, I don't even know his name. Forgive me. Tell us his name. Tell us a bit about the history of you and this caddy, how long you've been together, and how critical your relationship with him has been.
Yeah, his name is Lionel Marichak. He's from Canada. He's 50 years old.
Okay.
He looks young, but yeah.
He doesn't look 50.
Yeah, I know. We actually got together on my second tournament in Japan. Okay. He is actually married to a Japan player. He has two kids, very, very nice kids. And we won our first two events together. And I think that's where it all started. Why, you know, I actually didn't know anyone in Japan. I had no friends. I had no connection about how to get caddies and stuff. So it was good having him. I needed someone who can speak English.
Yeah.
So I can feel more comfortable inside golf course. And he was the best fit.
Wow. I would say you were lucky, but it seems like you guys were meant to find each other.
Yeah,
what a story. Incredible. Okay, now I wanted to ask you what got you here so fast. Whether it's mentors, coaches, or your caddy, who do you think were really critical in your rapid growth? You're 19 years old, 11 months, and 17 days, which, by the way, means you're turning 20 in 13 days, correct? It's your birthday soon? When's your birthday? June 20, right? So happy birthday in advance. But so talk about who were critical that made you leapfrog so fast. Everybody else takes a slower journey, but you got here so fast. Who was so helpful for you for this journey getting to the top?
Yeah, first, you know I got here fast. I mean, too fast. I don't want myself to be overconfident. I want to take it slow as well. Take it day by day and, you know, just do what I was doing a week ago, maybe 3 days ago. And, you know, there's so many people who have supported me, my family. There's a lot of golfers also who supported me, Miguel Tabuena. There's a lot of golfers that I asked for advices. And the old coaches, Coach J3, he's been there also. He's the coach of Kuya Miguel. And, you know, they've been there supporting me every time I need advice or help. You know, I'm just so grateful that there's so many people, you know, supporting me. You know, I don't know if they believe me, but...
Amazing. But I wanted to ask you one more bit. Where did you get your mental toughness? Who helped you develop that, your mental toughness and calm on the course? And just your attitude that you're so tough. It's not easy, but that's the key to the great athletes. They're mentally tough. They're very present every moment.
I don't know if I'm mentally tough.
We think so.
I'm not very tough. I'm a little bit soft. But, you know, I'm very happy kind of person. When I'm in Philippines, I talk to everyone. I talk to the caddies. I love talking to them. But, you know, I just needed to be quiet, just so I keep myself calm. That's, I think, and breathing.
So do you do meditation or mindfulness?
No.
Activities? It's just the general mindset.
Yes.
Amazing. A little bit about Rory. Last question. So just last bit about Rory, and we know that you love his game. You've seen his tweets. How big was that for you yesterday in terms of seeing him wish you luck and in the end congratulate you?
Seeing Rory posting about me on Instagram and Twitter, it's very unbelievable. I want to say thank you for noticing me. but I hope I can ask him some advice. And wish him luck in upcoming US Open.
That's good. More than just a photo, she wants a bit of a chat with Rory. So this is the last thing, your message to the Filipino fans. They're excited for you for the Olympics, as you are too. Your last message to all your fans back home.
Sa lahat po ng sumuporta po sa akin and ngayon sumusuporta pa rin po, maraming salamat po and we'll keep going.
That you guys get the gold medal in the Olympics as well. So, and once again, our 2021 U.S. Women's Open champion, Yuka Saso. Maraming salamat and congratulations.
And congratulations once again. We're all so proud of you, Yuka Saso. And that'll do it for today. Thank you for joining us. I'm Carmina Constantino. If you want to revisit this episode, Dateline Philippines podcast is on Spotify and Apple Podcast. Play back this newscast too on ANC's YouTube channel and on ANC 24/7 on Facebook. Keep safe. Keep it here on ANC.